Good morning. Okay. So we're going to be continuing on in looking at Paul's voyage to Rome. I'm going to pause that for just a moment so we don't get too far ahead of ourselves. On Paul's voyage to Rome, if you remember last time, we kind of got to the point where they were close to being able to land at a certain island. They didn't know where it was. But they were getting real close to shipwreck. So I think what we're going to do here is we're going to start verse 14. And again, we'll read down through the end of the chapter. There's a few things that I want to be able to remind you of that'll come up when we're looking at the map here and some of the location aspects. So we'll go ahead and start in Acts chapter 27, verse 14. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called an Euroquil. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. Running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. After they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor and in this way let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. When they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice, and not to have set sail from Crete, and incurred this damage and loss. Yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of the Lord, to whom I belong, and whom I serve, stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island.' But when the 14th night came, as they were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms, and a little farther on they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms. Fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. But as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out the anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, 'Unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. Until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you will perish.' Having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. All of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. All of us in the ship were 276 persons. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea. When day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind. They were heading for the beach. But striking a reef where two seas met, they ran a vessel aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And so it happened that they all were brought safely to land." All right, so where we left it last week was where Paul, in verses 20 through 26, he gives some comforting words to those that were on the shore. Just as a quick review, we'll just kind of flip through some of this where we were. Remember, we started out in Jerusalem, looked at the Temple Mount for real briefly, and then, can everybody see that? Does it look blurry to anybody? I mean, looks okay? Yes, no, maybe? What's that? Okay. And then talked a little bit about some of the places that Paul had stopped on the way to Caesarea. And of course, we know that Paul had spent a couple years in Caesarea. We looked a little bit at Herod's Praetorium and talked about some of the things that Paul would have seen in that area. Wow. And then started his voyage out, talked a little bit about some of the trip that he would have made along the shore. And then, of course, out into the sea. So we're just going to skip forward ahead here a little bit. Kind of gives you an idea of the distance that he's traveled. And Antioch and Tarsus were along the way there, so it would have been an area that he had been familiar with. One of the things that we wanted to point out here, and this is why I brought out some of these cities, is that the sailors would have recognized a lot of the shoreline that they were in. So obviously Luke had as well, and whether or not it was Luke himself who had recognized these areas or if it was the sailors who had mentioned it, they were certainly seasoned sailors and knew where they were going. So this is Cnidus or Nindus, depending upon which translation you take. And then over to Salmone, which was that promontory point. At this point, they're trying to land, if you will, to try to find safe harbor in a place called Lasea Beach, which is still there today. They were trying, ultimately, to get to Fair Havens, but they weren't able to make it and stay very long because of the weather. And then at that point, they decide that they're not going to make it. So they're going to go to, they were going to try to make it to Phoenix, couldn't make it, and then ended up sailing and then being tossed about in the Adriatic Sea for a while, drifting about. And they're going to land on the island of Malta, which we'll get to here in just a bit. But in verses 20 through 26, there have been several days without seeing the sun or the stars. So you can imagine a pretty rough thunderstorm, if you will, in Montana. It doesn't generally last very long. Maybe a couple hours in the afternoon, we get a few inches of rain sometimes, and wind blows, and it howls, and it clears up. But on the sea, in this particular area, in this particular time of the year, which would have been somewhere around October, mid-October to early November, that's not so in this particular situation. A lot of violent weather in this area. I couldn't imagine, again, being on a handcrafted wooden ship in the middle of a sea and not be able to see the sun or the stars for a couple of days. That would not be something that I would want to do. Pretty adventurous person, but that is outside of my bailiwick. No, thank you. But the sailors, you think about it now, they're not all the sailors. Remember, there's 276 people on this boat. So all of the sailors, and probably a lot of the prisoners, and the soldiers, and I'm sure Paul and Luke and Aristarchus are all involved in keeping this ship afloat in one way or another. Maybe they're pumping the bilge out. Maybe they're filling cracks in the mortar. Maybe they're, you know, bracing the ship in whatever way that they can. But this is not simply something they're just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. So the sailors and probably the prisoners have been hard at work keeping the ship afloat. And after a long abstinence from food, Paul addresses those on the ship and he reminds them that they should have listened to him. I appreciate Paul. He's not one to, you know, to be soft on people, but he's like, I told you not to do this. You should have listened to me. And then, of course, he goes on to encourage them to take heart, for he promises that no lives would be lost, but only the ship. So as they continue on, Paul talks to them, and he says, an angel of the Lord appeared to him, telling him not to be afraid, because he has to appear before Caesar. And the other part of that is that God has granted all of the lives of those on board the ship with him. Now, if you look at this, let's go back to those verses here in 27. Verse 25, he says, therefore, keep up your courage, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. Now, Did the Lord have to grant to Paul all the lives of the people on the ship? No. I mean, the Lord could have just as easily made the ship crash and he float on a barrel to Rome. I mean, you know, the Lord could have done whatever he wanted. Yet, I think there's an interesting picture here. And that is ultimately the compassion of God. And we'll see a few more examples of that as Paul continues on, and especially as he lands in Malta and spends some time there. But this really, I think, reveals the compassion of God, that he doesn't want people to perish. He wants them to repent. And here's a guy, Paul, who is the apostle to the Gentiles. And he's on this ship with a bunch of people. And so the Lord encourages Paul to encourage them, and he encourages them to take heart that though they are going to run aground, they're going to crash, they're going to wreck, none of their lives would be lost. So here in verses 27 and 28, there's a couple of things that I want to point out here, because we're going to talk about these. But verse 27, he says, "But when the 14th night came," so they've been 2 weeks, okay, 2 weeks since they'd been drifting, "On the 14th night, when they were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. They took some soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms, and a little farther on, they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms." Okay, anybody know how long a fathom is? Oh, I knew you'd know. I'm glad you're here. You just looked it up. Oh, come on. I figured that was an opportunity to say, yes, all things diving I know, so... A fathom is about 6 feet, okay? So if they take a measurement of the fathoms, let's see, how many fathoms was it first? About 20 fathoms. How deep is that? 120 feet, okay? So if you keep going in a particular direction, and then you take another measurement, and it's 15 fathoms, what does that mean? Yeah, obviously you're getting closer to shore. At least the water is getting shallower, right? Okay? So anybody know how many 15 fathoms is? 90 feet. Okay, this is important because it's actually really pretty cool. There's no like spiritual connection here. It's just we'll see some archaeological evidence that's actually really fascinating here in just a minute. But... So they're definitely coming up closer to shore. The decreasing measurements of depth means that they're getting closer to the shore. And in the process of all of this, and remember, you've got a ship full of 276 people. A number of them are prisoners, soldiers, and then of course Paul and his companions. They cast how many anchors over shore or over the boat? Four. They cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. Okay? So, but as this was happening, some of the sailors, who were the trained guys, right, not the prisoners, but the sailors, they know this isn't going to be good. And so they try to take the skiff or the little boat that's attached, it's essentially the rescue vessel, if you will. But Paul and the... basically says, no, they can't do this. If they get off the ship, we're all dead. Okay? So they cut the boat away, let it fall off the ship, and then about dawn, okay, so remember, they had, about midnight came, they started taking the soundings, so about dawn, Paul encourages them to eat something, and I appreciate Paul for a lot of reasons, but verse 33, "Until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have been certainly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you will perish.' Having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all. And he broke it and began to eat." Why was Paul going to Rome? To appeal to Caesar, because he had been accused of basically all kinds of things from the Jews. Specifically, if you want to get down to it, it was blasphemy, is what he was accused of. And how did the Romans feel about preaching the Christ? They didn't like it. Because remember, Christianity was not an officially recognized religion. It was a considered a part of this, a sect of Judaism. So Paul, despite this, takes a moment and he, in the presence of all, breaks bread and offers thanks to God. And remember, he had reminded them a little earlier, you should have listened to me. But because you didn't, we're in this situation. But fear not, the Lord has told me that all of you are going to live. Okay? So Paul takes bread in the presence of all of them. All of them were encouraged, and they took some food. Okay. So, as it mentions there in verse 32, there were 276 people. As I've mentioned a couple of times, there are 276 people on the ship. And they continue then to try to lighten the ship by throwing what was left of the wheat into the sea after they'd eaten their fill. And then in the daylight, they tried to run the ship into a bay with a beach. Now let's go down to chapter 28, verse 1. It says, when they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. Obvious question. Did they know where they were before they landed? Okay. It's obvious, right? Now, I want to show you something on the map here. And this just shows you the difference between tradition and, well, what we'll call good archaeology. Huh. Interesting, it didn't save my change. Oh, well, let's go over here. So, this spot in Malta is referred to as St. Paul's Bay. Now, why do you think that? That's what they think. Or at least that's what tradition tells us, is that Paul landed somewhere in this bay. Okay, so the couple of things about this. The island of Malta at this particular time, and we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail here in just a bit, you can see it's not very far off Sicily. The Roman Empire controlled this area for several hundred years by this time. Well, for about, I shouldn't say several, it's like 250 years had been under Roman control. This was a very well-known seaport to Roman soldiers and Roman sailors. This northeastern seaport here. Very well-known. So do you think it would be that the soldiers wouldn't know where they were if they landed there? Probably no. They would have known. They would have had some recognition of it. Okay. However, down here in what is called St. Thomas Bay, there's actually some really interesting archaeological evidence to support the fact that this is actually where they landed. So, a couple of things before we get to that, some of that archaeological evidence. If we continue on back here in Acts chapter 27, verse 39, it says, when day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, so when it means cast off the anchors, remember how many anchors they'd thrown over the boat? Four. And when it means cast them off, it means they cut the lines. So they cut the lines so that the ship could just go freely, right? And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind. They were heading for the beach. So when they hoist the foresail, they let the rudder go. Hoisting the foresail means that they're catching air. Ship's moving faster, right? So they want to push that ship as far into land as they can, okay? But striking a reef, so now there's a couple of things I want to stop and talk about for just a second. We know, for instance, depth. Remember, 120 feet to about 90 feet. They cast four anchors. Put them over the sea, over the side of the boat, right? Try to slow the ship. Then they cut the lines for the anchors. So where are the anchors? They're at the bottom of the sea in about how many feet of water? About 90 feet of water. Okay? Then they, of course, run the ship And then there's a reef. Oh, and also, there's a point where there are two seas that meet. So if you take these clues and you put them out separately and you just kind of look at it, it's almost like a treasure map. I mean, think about it. All this wonderful detail that Luke puts into this particular set of scripture and this recording of these events, I mean, this reads like a treasure map. Right? You got two seas coming together. You got a shore with a reef. It's about 90 feet deep. Okay? I think it's kind of cool. So, anyway, they strike this reef, verse 41, but striking a reef where two seas met, they ran the vessel aground. And the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. So at this point, the soldiers plan to kill the prisoners. Now, why were they planning to kill the prisoners? Yeah, because they didn't want to have to deal with the repercussions of a bunch of escaped prisoners and being Roman soldiers and having some responsibility for these prisoners. They didn't want to have to deal with it. But remember, a couple of times Paul had reminded them, all of you will be fine. Just listen. The God to whom I belong and whom I serve has said all of you are going to be fine. Yeah, sometimes people don't listen, which, you know, shouldn't surprise us and doesn't. But they were planning to kill them and basically so that none of them would swim away and escape. Verse 43. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And so it happened that they all were brought safely to land. So we have the situation. The ship gets stuck. It's broken up by the waves. There's plenty of things floating around. It's kind of the classic, you know, shipwreck scenario with Robinson Crusoe. You know, they're all bedraggled and wet and cold and not very well nourished. And they're washing up on shore, okay? And they don't know where they are. But the Roman soldiers they weren't able to kill everybody. And I find it interesting here, in verse 44 of chapter 27, that they all were brought safely to land. I love the fact that Luke puts this in here. All 276 people on board were brought safely to the shore. That is remarkable. Now keep in mind, they'd been on a ship for 2 weeks, not seeing the sky or the stars, being tossed around in the Adriatic Sea, and then the ship wrecks on a shore, and not one of them is lost. That is highly unlikely. I mean, it is literally miraculous that all 276 of these guys survived. You do any research, historical research on that, and you'll find that most people, if they were in a shipwreck, there were less than 1% of the crew generally would survive. So the fact that all of them came through is pretty miraculous. And what do you think that did for the minds of the guys who were on that boat? Think any of them realized that their likelihood of survival was pretty low? And yet Paul told them, all of you are going to survive. And guess what? They all did. Think that they started having just a smidge more faith in what Paul was saying? Now, of course, I'm sure on the boat, Paul was preaching the gospel to everybody that would listen. I doubt that. I really doubt that. Because we'll see what happens when he lands in Malta. Okay? I don't think that Paul was able to have nice Bible study sessions on the ship with a bunch of Romans and prisoners. I don't think that was the case. But how was Paul preaching the gospel? Through his actions and through his faith. Okay? So, chapter 28. Let's read the first 10 verses here, and then we'll get to some of this. We'll just read a couple of verses, and then we'll get to some of this evidence here. Chapter 28, verse 1. When they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. Okay? The natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain they had set in, and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. So we'll stop there for just a second. So they land They get on the shore, and there's natives. Now, when I say the word natives, and you think of an island, you're probably thinking of a bunch of guys running around in loincloths with feathers in their hair, colors on their faces, and spears, right? It's not the case. Okay? This particular word is actually the Greek word for barbarian. But that doesn't help any either. Then you think of guys like Scott with, you know, horned helmets and shields and knives, you know. No. That's not what that means either. It just means they didn't speak Greek as their primary language. Okay? So these people were not uncivilized. It wasn't like a bunch of, you know, backwards tribesmen running around with loincloths and, you know, unga bunga, unga bunga, you know. None of that stuff. They were civilized people, but they just didn't speak Greek as a primary language. Okay, so they find out that they are on the land of in Malta. So the shipwreck probably occurred somewhere in late October to early November of 60 AD. And of course, we know they had to ask where they were. They didn't know where they were. And we talked a little bit about some of the traditional landing sites, St. Paul's Bay. And we talked about why that probably was not where Paul had been shipwrecked. It was a well-known seaport by this time. Roman sailors had been through that area many, many times. And it was, at the time, and is today, quite suitable for large vessels. Now, there were several clues that Luke had given us throughout this particular section that shows, that tells us that this couldn't have been the area. There's no reef outside of St. Paul's Bay. The waters aren't that shallow in St. Paul's Bay. And the Romans would have known it. So it doesn't make sense that the traditional location of St. Paul's Bay would be where Paul actually landed.
Aside from all that also, you got to consider the direction that they're traveling and the fact mm-hmm. that they ain't going to have time or the energy to go around the island to come in where right. they knew. Mm-hmm. They're just making a beeline for the land and right. hoping to make it.
Absolutely. And that, remember, they cut the rudder and they got rid of the anchors and they drove the ship into the shore because they didn't have any idea where they were.
Well, just really thankful for that. I just realized I always pictured tribesmen on the coast. But it makes sense because in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul's teaching on tongues, right? And he says every language has its meaning. And so if you speak a language and don't understand its meaning, the one who speaks and the one who listens become a barbarian to one another. And he's literally just saying you just don't understand the language.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Thank you for that addition. Okay, so with all the things that we talked about concerning some of the evidence regarding St. Paul's Bay not being the traditional not being the actual location where Paul landed, there are actually two sites that for a long time had been suspected of being where Paul had actually landed. Now, I'm not going to go into the evidence for the other one because there is one that actually fits the bill, okay? So this is in St. Thomas Bay here, and I'll zoom back out here if I can get my mouse back over there. All right. So you can see that this is on the southeastern side of the island, but primarily on the eastern shore, which, as Super David pointed out, I mean, if they're coming from the Adriatic Sea, they're most likely going to run aground on something that's facing them. You know, they're not going to go around the shore, okay? So, this St. Thomas Bay, the shore depths, guess what they are? Just, anybody got a guess? About 90 to 120 feet deep. Okay? It was not a well-known or well-established seaport during the first century, so the sailors wouldn't have necessarily known what it was or where they were. The prevailing winds at this time of year, October, November, they come directly from the east, and they blow pretty much directly into the west. Remember that storm that came down, the Iroquilo? That comes out of the northeast, and it blows to the southwest. Okay? All right? And then, this is really cool. Lots of stuff. There are two seas that meet in this general area. Okay? And, you see this little thing right about here? What is that? That's a reef! And, within the last 100 years, there were some divers, some local divers. They were just happening to swim in some about 90 feet of water, and they found 4 Roman-era anchors in about 90 feet of water. Huh. And all of them were within 40 yards of each other. So, from one to the other, from the furthest one to the furthest one, there's 40 yards between them. Which, those could be, those were probably slung off the end of the ship and stuck in the ground there. Okay? So, they found these 4 anchors. And all of these features and the archaeological evidence makes St. Thomas Bay the most likely landing place. I love how God leaves those little tidbits. When we search for truth, we find it. So, St. Thomas Bay is probably where they landed. Not as it, as they, as tradition says, up here. Okay? So they're in St. Thomas Bay, and from here, they spend some time on the island of Malta. All right, so a couple of things here. Some of the inhabitants of this island, again, they were not a bunch of, you know, half-naked savages running around, but they could probably speak Greek or Latin, and were able to tell the survivals that they were on Melita. That would have been the name that they would have used. There is really no question that this is the island they landed on. This is what the Greeks and the Romans called Malta for a long, long time, was called Melita. And so then the natives made them welcome. Now, again, put yourself in this situation as one of those people who had come off the ship. It's cold. It's November, right? You've just been in a 2-week-long storm. You haven't eaten a lot in the last 2 weeks. You finally got a meal. You've just been shipwrecked, and you're floating up onto the shore. You don't know where you are, and you get to shore, and there's a bunch of people who speak a different dialect than you standing on the shore to welcome you. What's the first thing you're going to think? Oh, gee, I wonder if they have a Hilton. No, you're probably somewhat afraid, okay? So, as we discussed, Luke mentions that the natives make them welcome. They would have not been the barbarians that we've described, but instead, they would have been civilized people, okay? However, still pagans. So they certainly weren't Christians and they weren't Jewish. There was a very, if any, there's really no evidence of a Jewish population, and especially this portion of the island, in this time frame. So they were certainly pagans. I mean, they probably worshipped the Phoenician gods. Most likely, those from this area came from Phoenicia. So again, worshipping the Phoenician gods. But they were the ones who had received these wretched unfortunates who were huddled on the shore in pouring rain, cold and weary from exposure. So these are the guys who had welcomed them. Let's go back to Acts chapter 28. And we'll read a few more verses here. Chapter 28, we'll just start in verse 1. And we'll read down through verse 10. When they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. The natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened itself on his hand. When the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, "Undoubtedly this man is a murderer, and though he has been saved from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." However, he took the creature off, shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. But they were expecting that he was about to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But after they had waited a long time and had seen nothing unusual happen to him, they changed their minds and began to say that he was a god. Now in the neighborhood of that place, where lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us, and entertained us courteously 3 days. And it happened that the father of Publius was lying in bed, afflicted with recurrent fever and dysentery, and Paul went in to see him, and after he had prayed, he laid his hands on him and healed him. After this had happened, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases were coming to him and getting cured. They also honored us with many marks of respect, and we were setting and when we were setting sail, they supplied us with all we needed. Okay, let's cover a couple of things here. We're probably not going to get to the next section on the slides or on the map, so no big deal there. But okay, these guys are pagans. Okay, so they're not Jewish. They're most likely, as I've mentioned, Phoenician. They certainly don't worship the Christian God. They're not Christians, and so they see this happen to Paul. Now let's step back for just a second. What was Paul doing? He's gathering wood. I think that's a good example of leadership. Stuff needs to be done, so do it. He didn't act like, you know, Pope whatever and sit around and let everybody else do the work. He got to work. He was just as cold and miserable as the rest of them. But he didn't consider himself any more important than anybody else there. So you can see his characteristic ethic here of not holding himself as more important than any others. He got involved in the work to be done. And he was gathering sticks for the fire. I mean, it reminds me of Peaks and the goal fires that you can see from space. you can, I'm pretty sure. Especially when Caleb's in charge of it, but that's a whole other story. But he was gathering sticks for the fire. And there's this snake that, you know, a viper that bites him on the hand. And of course the pagans are like, you know, this is justice. That this guy's got to be a murderer and our goddess, Justice, isn't going to let Paul get off on this. So, interesting. Paul didn't die and he didn't swell up. Now, if you've ever seen pictures of people who have been bitten by vipers, and like a pit viper is a good example, that's a rattlesnake, they'll generally swell up real bad. I mean, it's not pleasant, and if they die from it, it's even obviously worse. But they're expecting Paul to die, okay? So the islanders in this particular case, they figure that justice would be served by their pagan god and that he would die or swell up and get very sick or something, but he doesn't. Reminds you of something that maybe the Lord had said. Mark chapter 16. Let's go over there. Mark chapter 16. We'll just get verses 17 and 18. This is Jesus speaking to the disciples, and he says, "These signs will accompany those who have believed in my name. They will cast out demons, they will speak with new tongues, they will pick up serpents, and if they drink any deadly poison, they will not be hurt. It will not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover." Huh. Now remember, this is during the first century. Okay, I am firmly convinced that these are parts, if you will, of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and that they are not around anymore. So, you know, we're not going to start jumping pews and shouting hallelujah and dancing with snakes. It's not the way it works, okay? But this is characteristic of what the Lord had said regarding what those his servants would be able to do and with really withstand. So they assume that Paul was a murderer. Now, why would they assume that he was a murderer? Well, because he got bit by a snake. But why would they think that he was on the ship? Well, he was a prisoner. Well, how did they know he was a prisoner? Well, presence of Roman guards. And I'm pretty sure that when they all got to the shore, the Roman soldiers were careful to keep an eye on all of them. So there's a lot of things that aren't being mentioned in the background details that help to fill in a lot of the gaps when you stop and consider them. So when Paul had not fallen dead or been affected by the bite in any way, they changed their minds and they believed him to be a god. Okay. Does this remind you of anything else that Paul had encountered before? But reverse. In this case, they think he's a murderer, But then they worship him because he doesn't, well, they consider him a god and therefore consider him worthy of worship. But this happened in just the reverse when Paul was in Lystra. Because remember, they thought Paul and Barnabas were gods. When Paul and Barnabas told them, nope, we're not gods, what happened then? They stoned them, right? Drug them out of the city and stoned them. So, if you think about both of those situations, you have pagan religions making assumptions based upon what they see and what they think to be true. Both of them are wrong, and it just illustrates the unevenness of pagan perception of deity. This, you know, we tend to think of pagans as, you know, guys running around again with, you know, doing the goat sign and all that other kind of stuff. And pagans are basically anybody that doesn't believe that Jesus is Lord, right? If you want to put it from the perspective of today, it's the world, right? So pagans have a flawed view of deity. You ever study with somebody who has a flawed view of deity? Oh, yeah. Most people that you study with have really no idea who Jesus really is and certainly don't really understand the relationship between Jesus and the Father and the Holy Spirit. So this is not something that's all that uncommon. We're going to go ahead and stop there because it doesn't make sense to continue on to this next section. Any questions or comments before we close up for the day? All right. Thank you for your kind attention.